This is Kate Turkington on Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
A very good morning to you from Johannesburg, where we're enjoying the most beautiful, it's a word I use, but you don't often hear it, autumnal weather. Not just autumn, but autumnal weather. That means cool mornings and a bit nippy in the early morning and evening, but in the daytime, absolutely lovely. And all the trees are just beginning to turn yellow and brown. It's a lovely, lovely time of year on the High Veld, maybe all over South Africa. So today, let me tell you what's coming up in the programme. We're going to be talking about a really fascinating and important report that the Oppenheimer Memorial Trust put out. And then I'm going to be taking you to one of my very, very favourite destinations, even though there's a lot of negatives, the pluses far outweigh the negatives. But first of all, good morning, Tracy. So good to talk to you.
So lovely to see you, and thank you so much, Kate, for having me on the show.
Now, before we start, Tracy, and I mean, I got hold of it, I think it was before Christmas I first read the education report, and I thought, oh, boring education research. I must tell you, I picked it up and I didn't put it down. I read it from start to finish. But before we go to that, just tell us, remind us once again about the Oppenheimer Memorial Trust, what it does, who it is.
So the Oppenheimer Memorial Trust was founded in 1958 by Harry Oppenheimer as a memorial to his father, Sir Ernst Oppenheimer. And really from the get-go, they've been funding and supporting education. Back in the day, it was very much around scholarships. One of the first scholarships actually was provided to the Archbishop Desmond Tutu to attend, theology in London. So, you know, that was one of the first scholarships. And actually, when you look over the years, so many extraordinary individuals that are doing incredible work in South Africa over the years have actually been funded by the Oppenheimers to take up scholarships around the world and locally. So education, and then we also are passionate about social justice, whether it's funding organizations that are working in the policy advocacy litigation space, voter education, you know, any of the social justice areas, corruption, you name it, we fund it. And then arts and culture. So they've always had a deep passion for supporting arts and culture, which is so critical, as many donors actually don't fund that sector. And it really is important for everyone to participate in. Today, we focus on the entire value chain of education. So we look at early childhood and development. We look at basic education, and then we do continue with funding honors only with SolPlaki, which we launched this year. And then we fund masters, PhDs, postdocs, sabbaticals. And then we also launched an award last year called the New Frontiers Award, which is awarded to a early to mid-career academic that is pursuing cutting edge and globally relevant research. And then our penultimate award, which is like the Nobel Prize, is the Harry Oppenheimer Fellowship Award, which is awarded to an A-rated academic at the height of their career that is really doing globally relevant work.
Okay, Tracy, we're coming back to you after the break.
This is Kate Turkington on Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
Welcome back. I'm talking to Tracy Webster. She's the CEO of the Oppenheimer Memorial Trust, and she's been telling us some of the things, a lot of the things the Memorial Trust does. And just out of interest, Tracy, before we go on to the education report, years ago, when you were a little girl, I made a film about Salt Plaikie in Kimberley. At Fitz Television, we actually made a film about Salt Plaikie. And can you believe Johnny Clegg did the music? And somewhere in the archives of Fitz, that film, hopefully, is still there. Because Salt Plaikie was unknown in those days. Now he's got a street named after him because of the Oppenheimer Foundation, the Memorial Trust, supporting him. And as you know, he was the very first black South African to translate Shakespeare into a local language. He was wonderful, amazing, amazing, amazing man. Anyway, about this education report, education research, as you said, it took us through all phases of education from early development right up to university level and beyond. First of all, how on earth did you do the research?
Well, you know, I always believe in a multi-stakeholder approach. And so we went to the experts. So we interviewed well over 100 people, whether it was NGOs that are working in the education space, whether it was, people sitting in government, other philanthropists, and then subject matter experts that have been writing about and producing research around the state of education across South Africa. So we ensured that not only did we do desktop research, and, you know, obviously you have to draw a line in the sand. There comes a point when you can no longer do all the desktop research and you have to draw your own conclusions. But I'm pleased to say that I felt it was a very a multi-stakeholder approach. With regards to ECD and youth, we actually held hackathons where we would put up problem statements. We would, you know, get a group of experts together, again, from all different sectors as well as the youth, to really hack out what are some of the solutions.
That's a totally new word for me, a hackathon.
Exactly.
I think my family has a lot of, I think any family does, has a lot of hackathons. But let's start at the beginning with the early childhood development. What did you find there?
Well, I think the reality is that, you know, so many, more than 50% of our children just actually don't have access to early learning. And then those that do, only about 30% have access to quality early learning. So we need to do two things. We need to make sure that every child has access to early learning and that the early learning they have access to is quality. And that we need to ensure that every child is thriving by five. So there was a Thrive by Five report that was launched by our department together with some donors that had funded the research to really say these are the five critical areas that a child needs to be thriving in before they actually start school. And if we don't get that right, then you know your grade R and grade one and foundation phase teachers have this backlog that starts from the very beginning of your education journey, which speaks later on to why so many children are never able to catch up and we have a high dropout rate before children are able to actually write their matric results. You know, I think it was Bill Gates that has a wonderful saying that says, the first 5 years of your life have so much to determines how the next 80 years of your life turn out. And the investment in early learning, not only around your own individual well-being, but it actually is proven to have an impact in your health, the health burden that the country carries, as well as the economic output of this country. So we can't deny that actually we have to sort that out and get it right.
I want to go into the basic education and higher education, but while we're talking about early childhood development, is it not pie in the sky that you're trying to achieve? How on earth Kakan early childhood development. You're living in a rural village in Zululand, or you're living in a shack in an awful township. How on earth can it be possible? I'm not being cynical. I think I'm being realistic.
And I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, yes, we have to be realistic. And we've been in talk with the Department of Basic Education. There's a group of excellent individuals that are really, you know, since there's been this function shift from the Department of Social Development to Basic Education, that are really thinking through how we scale this up, how we build a social compact between government, philanthropists, investors, and the NGO sector that have years of expertise, that have models that are working in a rural village, that are working in a township, where you're equipping, whether it's a mother in her shack that is working with 10 children. How do we ensure that she has the tools and the resources to be able to ensure quality? And there are a lot of models, NGOs that we've been supporting over the years that are doing brilliant work. And the good news is that government is saying, how do we work to scale up these organizations to ensure that we get to all of those children that are not being reached? So a lot of research has been done to around the population study. Where are those children sitting that don't have access? And I think there are going to be some interesting things over the next 2 years that I can't talk about now, that will be launched. We're very excited about the possibility of starting to really look at how do we scale up these organizations and ensure that we are, you know, measuring those outcomes to ensure that children are well equipped to start school. So it's a huge task. We're going to need a lot of money. We're going to need the NGOs pulling in the right direction. We're going to need investors, philanthropists, and government, and to really build a social compact. And I feel that it is starting to happen, and a government is leading this, and we're very excited about it. So watch this space.
Okay. When you're ready to make an announcement. But I mean, what the report reveals very, very clearly is Bill Gates' comment that early childhood development is the key, the actual key to practically everything. We'll come back again, Tracy, and talk more about that in a moment.
This is Kate Turkington on Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
I'm talking to Tracy Webster, who's CEO of the Oppenheimer Memorial Trust. Fascinating to hear that people like Desmond Tutu first got their opportunities because of the trust. But we're talking in particular about this comprehensive and amazing and very readable education research report that came out. And as Tracy said, what it revealed, without doubt, is that early childhood development is key to almost everything. But tell us about your findings in basic education, Tracy.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think the reality is that, you know, 10 children start school in grade one, 6 children write matric, 4 pass matric, 1 goes to university, and half a person finishes their degree within 6 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's, I think that tells us a story. The Pearls results came out last year, which is very disappointing, showing that, you know, 81% of our children cannot read for meaning by grade 4. But I'm pleased to say since we've launched this report, and obviously there's been a lot of media around it, we have had discussions with the DBE, and there's no doubt that children actually need to learn how to read and write in their mother tongue. And so I attended the launch that Basic Education had, the Department of Basic Education, to launch the Mother Tongue Bilingual Bachelor of Education. And so there is going to be change coming now, where children are going to be able to learn reading in their mother tongue and writing in their mother tongue while they are listening to English. So the idea is that it starts off with 80% of your learning is in your mother tongue and 20% you're listening in English. And as those years progress, it becomes 60, 40, you know, and so it progresses until by the time grade seven, you are bilingual. You are able to read and write both in your mother tongue and understand language and speak and understand English. And we have to do that because often in a rural school, as you said earlier, what is the only asset that a child has when they come into the classroom? And quite frankly, the only thing they have is their mother tongue. Mm-hmm. And so we need to reach them in understanding concepts in their mother tongue while they are hearing communication in English. And so, yes, we have to test that out. There have been pilots done in the Eastern Cape that have yielded good results. So I remain hopeful that we have to tackle that. In fact, we've decided as a trust is we have to tackle that.
And Tracy, out of interest, are there other countries who do this? Are there international models?
There are international models, but not all of them have 11
languages.
Different languages. So, you know, provincially, you know, the provinces are going to have to decide which is the language that leads. Is it isiZulu coupled with English? Is it isiSuthu, etc.? So, you know, this is more complex for South Africa, given the fact that we have 11 languages. But we have to do something different. You know, we can't keep doing the same thing and expect different results. And I do believe that this is the way forward. There's been a lot of research around learning in your mother tongue language. And you've got to get those basics. You've got to get the foundation phase down before you can start adding more concepts going forward. So I'm in full support of mother tongue learning in the foundation phase with regards to literacy and numeracy.
And what about, you know, the report looks at early childhood development, looks at basic education. What did you find with higher education?
The one thing about the basic education also is that 50% of our teachers will be retiring by 2030. And so we also believe that there is this once in a generational opportunity to really train well-qualified teachers and populate the classrooms with good teachers. And I think all of us have an experience where we would point to that one teacher that really saw us, that really drew us out, that really inspired us. And I think, you know, every child deserves to have teachers that are able to do that and are able to you know, really inspire them and get them on that learning journey. And I think that is going to be a huge opportunity, but also a huge challenge, because what's come out is that we're not preparing well-qualified teachers in terms of pedagogy and content knowledge. And so really the challenge is now sitting with the universities to relook and innovate on their BA degree, to get closer to the classroom, to ensure that young people are exposed to the classroom, that understand how you build your lesson plans, understand the practice of teaching. It's not just about learning concepts. It all goes down in that classroom. How are you getting that concept across to children? There's a huge amount of work that has to be done at a BA level to ensure that we get the right type of teacher into the classroom.
I was thinking, just playing devil's advocate here a moment, I have a young friend from a rural village in Northwest who's actually got herself 2 degrees. And she says she goes back to her village and tries to inspire and motivate her nieces and nephews and children of her friends. And they say, but what's the good of getting a trip? We're not going to get a job anyway. Why should we bother? What would be your response to something like that? That's a tough one.
I think there are enough examples of young people that have gone on to get a matric, that have made something with their lives. And for me, it's two things. It's a psychological win. Mm. And I think in this day and age, as an individual, you have to set yourself a goal and you have to try and achieve that goal. It doesn't matter what that goal is. But I think to be able to get your matric is proof to yourself that you're able to apply your mind, you're able to study, you're able to sit down and write an exam under pressure. Now, you might not get a job, but if you can achieve that goal, why can't you then apply your mind to maybe setting up a small business or doing something? Because you've built memory, muscle memory around an achievement, around success. And I think that's what life's all about, Kate. I mean, if it's running a marathon or, you know, whatever that goal is, we have to continuously keep giving ourselves goals and learning about failure. So even if you set yourself a writing matric and you don't pass, what is that lesson around failure? How do you get up again and start something else? And I think we've got to be comfortable with failure as well and saying, I will try again next year. I'm not going to give up. I'm going to pull myself up and try again. And so we mustn't see it as an entry into a job ever. A matric is just the next stepping stone to the next thing you want to do, whatever that thing is that you want to do.
Oh, that's very inspirational and practical. Thank you, Tracy. And when you finally tell us what the practical plans are for the early childhood development, please come back and talk to us. Thanks so much.
I'd be delighted, and thank you so much for having me.
That's Tracy Webster, CEO of the Oppenheimer Memorial Trust. Okay, we're going to talk now about one of my favorite holiday destinations, even though it's difficult in some ways, but really well worth the effort. It's the largest island in the Caribbean. You've all heard of it. Maybe you've always wanted to go there. What is it? It's Cuba. I'm lucky enough to have been there twice. And as with many of my destinations, I go back in a heartbeat. But first of all, just let me tell you some of the things that you would find when you go to Cuba. It's a very affordable destination still. The music, the people, the atmosphere, the beaches, the historic places, UNESCO World Heritage Sites are absolutely wonderful. But, let me just give you an overview of some things first. I mean, there is an economic crisis in Cuba. I mean, we know that. We think we've got load shedding. I mean, that euphemistic term that the government uses for blackouts. In Cuba, they actually call them blackouts. So there are blackouts a lot of the time. There's acute shortages of food and medicine and basic items. So, but if you go as a tourist, obviously, you're going to be looked after. And also, the government controls virtually all the media in Cuba, and it restricts access to outside information. So very often independent journalists and critics get imprisoned or punished in some way. And I was telling Harry Selecki, my producer, just before we came on air, I mean, you can't buy books in Cuba. Remember, it's a communist state. You can only buy communist literature. And if you take magazines, whatever magazines, from Hello to BirdLife Africa, those magazines will go through dozens and dozens and dozens of pairs of hands before they finally fall apart. And medical care is very, very patchy. A lot of medical basic items can't be got. So obviously, like anywhere, when you travel overseas, you take your own meds and you take your own prescriptions. And when you go to Cuba, you actually have to have medical insurance. You have to take either digital or printed proof of that, because they will check up on you. If you do forget, you can buy it at the airport for, I think it's about $30 now. And don't dabble in the local currency. Cubans, not US dollars, strangely enough, euros, and you can get your change maybe in little notes, little pesos, which is the currency of Cuba, but euros are the best currency to take. Is it safe? Totally. It's actually one of the safest countries in the Americas, particularly in terms of violent crime. Obviously, you're going to get your pickpocketing, but you know the rules. You don't wear flashy jewelry. You use the safe boxes in the hotel, and you don't flash cash in public. Shopping, cigars and rum, and beautiful handicrafts. Don't buy cigars from people on the street. They'll tell you that their auntie smuggled them out of the cigar factory. No, no, no. Actually stick to the state-run shops for your cigars, and also your rum from the actual government shops. Or, and I mean, I hate saying that and sort of not going to little local traders, but to be on the safe side, go to the government shops or the distilleries. You've got to do a tour around a cigar factory and a rum distillery. I'll tell you about that in a moment. And of course, wonderful, wonderful handicrafts. There's a huge warehouse in Havana. Your guide will tell you where. Massive scale, called the Mercado de Artesania, and it's full of little stores selling, think the waterfront, but not posh like that. Souvenirs, gifts, handicrafts, all kinds of things. Now, let me tell you about Cuba itself. So those are just some of the things. And whatever company you use to go, they will give you all that information. Of course they will. And of course, Cubans love South Africans because, as you know, Cuba supported the ANC when they were in exile. And a lot of them, of course, were. A lot of the comrades were in Cuba during the apartheid time. So they love South Africans. You just say you're from South Africa, you'll be treated like a queen or a king. And the way you get to Cuba is you actually fly via Madrid. And as you probably know, Madrid has one of the most famous art museums in the world called the Prado. I mean, they've got everything from Fra Angelico's The Annunciation. They've got works by Goya, El Greco, Marilla Bosch. They've got Hieronymus Bosch's The Garden of Delights. And of course, they've got Picasso's Guernica, which is a huge painting. And I was lucky enough. One of my friends who was traveling with me last time was an art teacher. And she actually stood there and talked us through Picasso's Guernica, which of course is a huge anti-war painting. So then you go off to Havana, and we stay, both occasions I've been to Cuba, I stayed at the Nacional Hotel in the middle of Havana on the seafront there. Think Mount Nelson, think Victoria Falls Hotel, think Raffles in Singapore. She's one of those grand old, what they call grand dames, old colonial hotels. The National in Cuba is a bit run down, but it's still massive. The rooms are massive. There's a creaky odd lift with those metal doors you pull across, and a little like clock with a handle above which shows you which floor you're on. An absolutely wonderful service. I will tell you the food in Cuba is awful, absolutely terrible, because there are government restaurants and they're a bit like going into a fast food chain and seeing the pictures on the wall. So you're shown you can have pork or fish, or what's the other thing? Chicken, pork or fish, and cabbage with everything. And the chicken, pork and fish all taste exactly the same. You wouldn't know what you were eating. But if you can get into a private house, and they do have private houses do offer meals, and I'm sure you can work your way into a little private restaurant, then the traditional Cuban food is wonderful. So you take lots of snack bars and snacks with you. And then, so you're staying in this amazing hotel where, of course, all the world and his wife stayed there in the 50s, the pre-revolution days. And then you'll go to the Museum of the Revolution. This is Che Guevara, Cienfuegos, and of course Fidel Castro. Amazing, amazing museum to go to. Then you go to a rum factory, incredibly interesting. But for me, the most interesting thing was a visit to a cigar factory. Now, I want to tell you exactly what this visit entailed. Don't think factory. Think rather a Dickensian kind of barn with windows, with cardboard over the windows or cracked panes, and workers sitting at benches, wooden benches on wooden tables, and they are rolling cigars. But I'll tell you more after the break.
This is Kate Turkington on Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
And I'm talking about Cuba, and I'm telling you about a visit to a cigar factory in Havana. And I said, don't think factory, modern gleaming machines, instruments. It's straight out of a Dickens novel. It's like a barn, if you like. And as I said to you, cracked windows, cardboard over the windows, wooden floor. The workers sit together on wooden benches, working on wooden tables. You know, they do say that a really good cigar has to be rolled on a virgin's thigh. Well, I'm not sure about that, but they were certainly rolled in front of us as we watched. But do you know what the entertainment was? To keep the workers happy, in the morning, there's a dais, how do you pronounce that? Dais, dais, I'm not sure. Anyway, there's a raised platform at the end of the room, and on it sits a reader, a real person. In the mornings, that reader reads to you the news, Cuban style, heavily censored. As I said, there's no freedom of the press in Cuba. So in the mornings, the reader reads to them the news. In the afternoon, another reader, reads to them from Cuban literature, which in all fairness doesn't have an amazing number of titles in it. So that's the cigar factory, and as you leave, sort of touts come up to you and offer you cigars that, as I said to you, their uncle or auntie has smuggled out of the factory. Don't believe it. Buy them from the government shops. And the National Hotel overlooks the Malecón, and the Malecón is very famous. It's a seafront promenade. That's where you see all the ladies in their shrink-wrap dresses and the wonderful old motor cars. And by the way, the wonderful old motor cars, wonderful, wonderful vintage models, aren't just there to delight tourists. They're there because you can't get new cars in Cuba. You haven't been able to get a new car for decades. So these old cars are kept going really on a hymn and a prayer. And there are horse-drawn carts taking workers to work. There are lorries thundering along the roads. And by law, if you see a hitchhiker, a government lorry or a horse-drawn conveyance has to stop and give that person a lift. So, I mean, look, it's a very wonderful, friendly society. The Cubans are amazing. And as I was saying to Harry, my producer, who's a music man, the music, of course, is wonderful. Think Buena Vista Mocha, Music Club. Is it Buena Vista Social Club? Buena Vista Social Club. Everywhere you go, there's wonderful music. So if you stick to the music and the mojitos, you're going to have a wonderful holiday. And of course, the history is absolutely unbelievable. There's a little town called Trinidad, which is the whole town, a bit like Pilgrim's Rest, is a national monument. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, but not run down, alas, like our Pilgrim's Rest. It's stepping back into time, absolutely beautiful. Old buildings, cobbled streets, ladies sitting smoking cigars, and I can't remember their official name, but the voodoo ladies who dress all in white and are like the Sangomas of Cuba. They'll tell your fortune or give you a potion or a spell. And there's a lot of belief. It's a Catholic country, but the voodoo religion, if you can call it that, exists side by side. So you must go to Cienfuegos, too, named after one of the leaders of the revolution. There's a mausoleum and a museum dedicated. He had a very extraordinary life too. But Cienfuegos is known as the Pearl of the South, and there are beautiful palaces and mansions overlooking a deep bay. Some of these old mansions and palaces, particularly if you go off the tourist route in Havana or one of these old cities, then you see these palaces and mansions have been totally taken over by squatters, taken over by people who have no homes. So they've got washing hanging outside. They desperately need a facelift, some of them, but they are still beautiful. And then after an early breakfast, because you've done so much that day, the next day or whenever, you go to Santa Clara, which is the final resting place of Che Guevara. And even if you know nothing about him, you've seen him on t-shirts, you've seen him on posters, that rakish looking fellow with the beret and the moustache and the charisma. And a friend of mine, we were driving along Winnie Mandela Drive in Santon the other day, and there are pictures of Julius Malema, posters of Julius Malema, and blow me down, he's wearing a beret and trying to look a bit, I think, like the late great Che Guevara. For my money, doesn't have quite the charisma. But it's an amazing museum of Santa Clara, and it's got an eternal flame inside commemorating his memory, because he, of course, with Fidel Castro and Cienfuegos, were the three leaders of the revolution that toppled the fascist government and really thought they were bringing democracy with all its joys to Cuba, which it did for a little while. And by the way, I'm off very shortly to Argentina, and I'm going to tell you all about that when I come back. But of course, Che Guevara wasn't Cuban. He came from Argentina. He was a doctor from Argentina, but charismatic, mesmerizing, one of these leaders that the world will never, ever forget. And then one goes to, as I say, to the little town of Trinidad, which is, as I told you, is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And it's actually one of the best preserved colonial cities in the world. You can explore on foot. You don't, it's a perfect place to walk around. So you go to what's called the Romantic Museum, which really is about the lifestyle and architectural design, Cuban music, and then you can go, there's a wonderful old house called the Canchanchara, and it's an old house which dates back to the 18th century, and then you can have a Trinidad rum cocktail made with cane juice. And of course, there are sugar cane plantations all over Cuba. So it really is a wonderful, wonderful place to visit. Having told you about some of the things, you know, that aren't sound worse than they are. When you go there, you'll be totally, totally enraptured by the place. And as I said, I'd go back in a heartbeat. And just before we finish today, I've got so many books I want to talk about, but I've got just a couple I'll tell you about after the ad break.
This is Kate Turkington on Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
I'm just going to tell you, can't go into details about some of the books I've really, really enjoyed over the last couple of months. So if you've got a pen or pencil and paper there, it's worth jotting these down. You want to read anything by the American author called Anne Patchett. That's P-A-T-C-H-E-T-T. Anne Patchett. I promise you, everything she writes, she's won Pulitzer Prizes, she's won Orange Prize for Fiction, she's won so many awards, and they're beautifully written, but they're not sort of highfalutin literary stuff. You will be gripped by everyone from the first page, I promise you. Her last one, most recent one, is called Tom Lake, and that's wonderful. But read, please, two of my favourites. She won prizes with both of them. One called Bel Canto, about an opera singer who's hijacked and kidnapped. And the other one, State of Wonder, which is like a retake of Comrade's Heart of Darkness. It's about a female woman medical doctor who goes into the jungle looking for a missing colleague. Absolutely wonderful. You won't put them down, I promise you. If you love thrillers, there's an amazing one out called Anna O. It's published by HarperCollins, and it's by Matthew Blake. And she, Anna O, is the character, the main character in the book. She hasn't opened her eyes for 4 years. Not since the night, actually. She was found in a deep sleep by the bodies of her best friends, and she was and is suspected of a chilling double murder. Can you murder if you're sleepwalking? Is it legal? It's a gripping, gripping novel. You'll love it, a crime novel. Very well written, too. If you like Paulo Coelho, and I'm sure many of you have read The Alchemist, he's got a new book out called Maktub, M-A-K-T-U-B. It's published by, or it's distributed by, Jonathan Ball. It is a hardback, and it's his essays from a newspaper over the years. He tells stories, for example, about the pianist Arthur Rubinstein, who was late for lunch at a classy New York restaurant. And he actually appeared. Friends began to get worried, but he finally appeared arm in arm with a spectacular blonde woman, 30 years his junior. I'm not going to tell you the rest of the story, but they're very short. The stories are just a page at a time, and it's a very nice book to have beside your bed. It's a great bedside reading. He's very philosophical, and he's very God-centered as well, but his common sense philosophy actually shines through. That's Maktub by Paulo Coelho, and you'll find it in all good bookshops. And if you're at all interested in trees, you all know about the African Baobab, and a lovely, lovely book published by Straight Nature is called just that, The African Baobab by Rupert Watson. And what Rupert Watson does, he explores the life and times of the majestic, it is majestic, baobab, and it's an ancient tree. Did you know it's outlasted every plant and animal around it? And that's including humans. You may have seen them in Kruger, you may have seen them up in Limpopo, you may have seen them wherever, in Botswana. Ethiopia has a wonderful forest of baobab trees, but it's a really lovely, lovely book, lovely prezi for anybody, and it has exquisite photographs and drawings of baobab trees all over. Talks about the flower, the seed, talks about all the ones you can see all over the world, particularly ours. There are even baobabs in Timbuktu, would you believe? So if you know somebody or you yourself are interested in trees, then the baobab, the African baobab by Rupert Watson, published by Straight Nature. Again, you'll find it in all good bookshops. So there you are. That's all for this week. Lots of reading. So interesting to hear about that Oppenheimer Memorial Trust education report. And there is light at the end of the tunnel. Email me on kate@hi.co.za if you'd like to talk about something or you'd like me to talk with somebody. So until next week, goodbye from me, goodbye from Harry Telecki, my producer, and our absolutely wonderful technical genius. We couldn't do any of this without Craig Guthrie. So we'll all be back next week. And stay safe, look after yourselves, and look after others too.